I'm Cliff Gooding, Grateful Alcoholic. Hey, my sobriety date is August the 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm really grateful. I want to thank Harlan and the committee for asking Lori and I to be here. And Lori was here last year. Some of you guys, anybody were here, remember Lori from last year? She was here, right? Alma? Yeah, I know you do, because this morning some lady came up to me and said, "Hey, look, there's Lori's husband." And that's how I knew. Steve, it's good to get a little humility before you talk up here. I'm just saying. And so, anyway, I'm really great. Until she drug two of her friends over, she goes, "Hey, this is the gal's husband. We've been listening to her CD all week long." So, Lori always says that we live in a two-story house, the truth and Cliff's story. So here it is today. And so, I'm glad you guys all braved the weather to get over here today, but it's actually beautiful. Yesterday was a beautiful day. It was really great. We had a great trip in. We brought Nell with us. I need to tell you all this, that today, Nell, who's going to be talking tomorrow, you don't want to miss that. Nell's, but today is Nell's 53-year anniversary in Al-Anon today. So happy birthday. Harlan was right about the speakers, except I can't attest to this one. But the other, I can tell you this, there's three of these speakers that I've personally booked at conferences where I've been in charge of the speakers, and it's a pretty powerful lineup and rather intimidating to be on the same panel with them. So I knew it was going to be a good weekend. When I left my house, when Lori and I and Nell, when we left our house on Wednesday to go catch the plane, my neighbor was outside. And he waved goodbye with all five fingers when we left. And so I knew immediately it was going to be a good trip. And I used all five fingers to wave back at him, and it was all good, you know. So, I want to thank especially my friends from Grants Pass who came up and came over the hill to be here this weekend, and really glad to be with him. Alcoholics Anonymous just... it's the greatest organization that nobody wants to join, you know. It's a powerful group of people, and you meet the best people here. You just really do. I met my friend Kenny. Kenny's here this weekend. Where are you, Kenny? There you are, right there. Kenny, you got 8 months sober. Met him out here this morning, and Kenny's at his first conference. I told him just to hang on, man. It's just, it's going to get weird, but then it's going to get good, you know. So here's the weird part here. So it's going to get better from here, I promise you, man, so. I grew up in rural southeast Oklahoma. I come from a little bitty town and called Hugo, and it's down in the southern part of Oklahoma, and it's poor people down there. And I grew up, I born in Paris, Texas, because that's where my mama was, and I wanted to be close to her when I was born. And so I was born in Paris, Texas, and so. We moved out to West Texas when I was a little boy, then moved back to Hugo because that's where my parents... I'm actually from Grant, really. I say Hugo because that's a big city. It's 5,000 people. Grant's about 200. Nope, y'all certainly don't know where that is. So I like to say Hugo. It's a good reference point. People understand and know where that is. So, but I grew up in a little big town, and we were poor. I mean poor. No running water, indoor toilets till I was about 10, 11 years old. It's poor, you know. And I remember I had a really good life, though. I need to tell you about it. I don't come from an alcoholic home. I got nobody to blame my alcoholism on. You know, I can't point a finger and say, that's what happened to me, and that's why I'm alcoholic. You know, I came from a really good home, a home that didn't have any alcoholism in it, a home that my parents got up and worked hard every day. From the time that daylight broke, they went out and worked the farm or went to their jobs or whatever. They worked till dark, And I had a really good life, man. I had a great life till I was about 5 and a half years old, man. Man. My mama one day got me up, and she gave me a bath and got me all dressed up in these clean clothes and shorts. And, you know, she marched me into town and pulled up in front of this little house. And I'm sure there's child abuse laws about this today, but she took me what they call kindergarten. And, when she opened the door, there had to be as many people as in here in that class that day, I promise you. There's probably about 15 kids in there, and every one of them head popped up and looked at me and just looked right at me. And something happened to me on that day. I'm alcoholic long before I ever took a drink, I know that, because on that particular day, What happened when those kids popped their heads up and looked at me, it became all about me. Absolutely all about me. You know, I heard one time Chuck C. used to talk about, you know, there's the whole world, God, and everything in it, and I'm over here. And he talked about how does a person have an idea like that? And the way you do that is you just have this idea that here's the world and God and everybody, and I'm out here. And that's how it was for me that day. It was like all those kids were looking at me, and it's like I looked at them, and they knew the answers to the questions, and I don't know what books they're reading out of. It was like that I was 15 minutes late in getting there, and I've been trying to catch my 15 minutes up all my life. I've just seemed like I'm a little bit out of step with everybody. I can't quite get to where I'm headed. And so what happened? I just became a chameleon. You know, whatever you were, whatever you needed me to be, that's who I'd be. And I took my first drink when I was about 11 years old. I held off as long as I could. It was for a long time, it was the greatest period of sobriety I ever had. And so it was my brother, it was a hot July day, and he cracked a Pony Country Club malt liquor. Some of you guys and gals are old enough here to remember Country Club malt liquor. And he handed it to me, and I took a big drink off of it, and something happened, you know. It wasn't that deal where I went out and immediately said, I'm going to do this every time I get a chance. And I lost everything I had because all I had was a bicycle back then. It wasn't that kind of experience for me. But it was a lot what Madeline talked about this morning. And thank you so much for your talk this morning, Madeline. It was great. By the way, a jackass carrying the message. Lori said that would be an upgrade for me, so that's good. So it had a profound effect upon me. And it was an effect that I would chase for a long, long time, trying to recapture something. I can tell you this. When I took that drink that very first day, it was like my 15 minutes got caught up like that. And suddenly I was in step with the world, you know. And the trouble with me is I've always been a minor chemical adjustment away from being all right. You know what I mean? I mean, I've just been. The trouble is I'm about a six-pack into it before I figure that out. I'm off already, you know. Somebody the other day was talking to me about balance. I said, I get balance, man. That's when you got a six-pack in each hand. You're balanced, man. Totally balanced. I totally get that. But I got my 15 minutes caught up, you know. And I can tell you, I wasn't a drinker in high school. I mean, I drank a little bit. I mean, I used to go in the morning my senior year in high school. My buddy and I, we'd go down to the Zippy Mart kind of deal, Quick Mart. Store all night, 24-hour place. We had a zero-hour class. It met at like 7 a.m. We get there about 6 o'clock, and the legal drinking age in Hugo in that particular time of year in Oklahoma was old, if big enough to get your money on the counter at 6 a.m. If you could do that, then you could get an 8-pack of Pony Millers, and we used to get 8-packs, and we'd split them right down the middle, and I'd drink 6, and he'd drink his 2, and anyway, we'd split them, And I'd just go to class as kind of a cool buzz, you know. It would just be a nice little buzz for the morning. It worked for me. But I never really had any consequences. And I'm just going to share with you this, is that an alcoholic of my type, the worst thing that can happen to a guy like me is to be a real live alcoholic, not have consequences. It just is. When I got away from home, I became a full-blown real live alcoholic. I went to college up at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater. And when I got away from home, it got turned on. The switch got flipped. And I became a blackout drinker. Now, I didn't know what blackout drinking was. You know, you guys ever saw those shows on like the Discovery Channel? They'll be talking and they'll say things. They'll be interviewing somebody and they'll say, well, tell us what happened. And they say something really weird like this. Is like, you know, I was at my home on Thursday night and then I woke up Saturday afternoon in a Holiday Inn. I was captured by aliens, you know, and they're not asking them the right questions. You know, what were you drinking on Thursday? That's the questions they need to be asking these people. I'm a classic overachiever. I mean, I got to fit in. I got to do better, outsmart, outthink, outrun everybody. And, you know, all my life I've been running from something, it felt like. Just running from something. I don't know what I'm running from. I'm just trying to get my 15 minutes caught up, and I'm a runner. And I'm just running. And I go to Oklahoma State University, and I do well there, and I graduate in 3 years. I get accepted to the University of Oklahoma Law School down in Norman, and I go down there. And the night before the LSAT exam, which is the acceptance exam for law school, I thought I would go out and just have a couple of drinks. with some friends of mine because they were just going to have a couple, and they called me. And I told them I was studying for the test. They said, we're just going to have two. I said, okay. And so I got in about 4 o'clock that morning. The test started at 8. It wasn't a good time. I bombed the test. It was horrible. I had really good grades, though. But I didn't get accepted. I was on a waiting list. I don't know about you guys. I suffer from self-esteem issues. You know, if I'm not first, I'm out, you know, kind of deal. So I got on this waiting list, and I just wasn't good enough. And 2 weeks before law school started, they called me and said, hey, there's somebody, a seat opened up, and it's yours. And so I went down to the University of Oklahoma, and I started law school there. When I started law school, I automatically went in just like the kindergarten class. I knew that everybody there was smarter than me, better than me, 15 minutes ahead of me, and I was in trouble. And so what I did, I was just gave up alcohol for a year. Now, I don't know about you all. I don't know what your experience is in drinking. Some of you guys might have come here and you quit drinking and your life got better. See, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I quit drinking. My life gets worse, you know. And I went to law school and I quit drinking. My life got worse. But I did really well my first year in law school. And so what I did was I gave myself permission to start drinking my second year, you know. And my grades kind of started to slide, but they hung in there pretty good. I graduated 7th in my law school class. During my second year down at the University of Oklahoma, I took my very first hostage. I've talked to several of y'all here. Don't laugh. I know you're hostage takers, too. I've been accused of being a serial marrier. I don't know if that's right or not, but I'm still waiting for the FBI profile to come in on that. But anyway, I took my very first hostage, she was an undergraduate at the university, and I was in law school. And when I graduated, 2 days after graduation, she served me divorce papers. And I'm going to tell you, I rationalized and justified, and that was okay with me because she didn't understand. My last year of law school, I was taking a full load of class. I was working downtown in Oklahoma City for one of those high tower law firms, and they'd give me a job teaching over at the university. I was teaching business law to sophomore, junior, and seniors over there. Well, that's somewhat equivalent, I understand, of putting the fox in charge of the hen house, is what I understand today. And I would go to those classes, and those co-eds would come up to me. I had a Tuesday, Thursday class that we were done about 9 o'clock, and they would come in. They'd say, Mr. Gooding, do you want to go have a beer with us? And I'd say, sure, absolutely. And I'd tell my wife, look, I'm going to be home after class. And I'd call her, and I'd say, some of the students want me to go out and drinking with them. And then Saturday, I'd make it home. And, you know, the trouble is she just got tired of living that way, and so 2 days after graduation, she served me divorce papers. And I thought, you know, that was okay because she just didn't understand. You know, guy working as hard as I do, providing as much as I did, I have a right to go out every once in a while and have a drink. And so that became okay for me. You know, what happens in my life, whatever I believe is the lowest point I can get, whatever boundary or whatever line I want to draw for myself, what happens to a guy like me is, you know, it's the high price of low living. I'll just draw another line and step right over it and say, this is my new line. If it ever gets this bad, then I'll stop. And I went to work for one of those high-powered silk stocking law firms in downtown Oklahoma City. I immediately got there and knew I was out of place in the wrong spot. I felt like that, you know, those guys were all smarter than me. They all knew more than me. I was running one more time. The only solution I know is to drink. We had a Christmas party the first year I was there. I made a commitment to myself. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to do any of this. I'm not going to do that tonight. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, one of the secretaries broke out some wine and said, would you like a glass of wine? And the only time I've ever really answered no to that question was if I misunderstood the question, really. So I said, yes, I would. And so it became a really bad night. I blacked out again, I found some Carmex in my pocket. Well, I had a senior partner that worked for this firm, and he was just a real stickler, man. I mean, he was the kind of guy that would clean his office before the cleaning people got there, you know. He would clean his desk off and have it totally had this glass, piece of glass on there. Well, I thought it would be really nice, apparently, because I don't remember. This is as reported to me. I thought it would be really funny if I wrote him a little note on his desk that night. It was a Friday night, so the whole weekend it sat up and hardened. It started with an F, and it ended with a U. It was a nice Yuletide message, and anyway, I left it there for him, and needless to say, my time at that firm kind of shortened up a little bit. You know, I had an opportunity to go somewhere else, and I was okay with me because, you know, those people just didn't really understand me. I didn't really fit in there. They didn't really understand. They didn't appreciate the work I was doing. Really, the work I was doing was beneath me, I just really needed to go ahead where I could really, you know, advance myself. And so I went to work for another firm, And I had some real success. Real success. And I was in Norman, Oklahoma on a Sunday night, which, by the way, is a great night to drink. And I was in Norman, Oklahoma on a Sunday night. I have to tell this story because we got a lot of ladies in the room I know who've never been to a men's bathroom before, so I want to be sure I set the stage correctly, you know. And so what happened was I went into the men's restroom on a Sunday night. I've been drinking down in Norman at this bar, and I went in there, and I followed a guy in there. And the ladies, there are several different kind of stalls you could have in a men's restroom. Some of these have these nice dividers in it. If any of you accidentally go into this bathroom here, if you happen to stumble in there, you'll notice really nice dividers and kind of you have a little privacy in there. And then sometimes you just have this big trough where everybody just kind of bellies up and it's a free-for-all, you know what I mean? And so, well, this is one of those free-for-all places. And so I'm in there, and the guy next to me, he takes out what appears to be the world's smallest baby spoon, and he starts putting things up his nose. And ladies, what I need to explain to you is this: if you're ever in a men's restroom and there's another guy in there, you don't want to get caught looking at him while you're in the bathroom. That's not good, you know. And so what happened on this particular night, I'm fascinated by this kind of activity going on, so I began to watch him, and he catches me. And so what he did, he just took this small baby spoon and just stuck it under my nose. And I don't know what your experience is, and I don't know what happens to you when you're drinking, but here's what you need to know about me. See, once I take a drink into my body, different guys starts calling all the shots for me. And it doesn't matter what I say, that I'm never going to do this, or I'm not going to do that, I'm never going to do this, all that goes out the door. Because on that particular night when that guy did that to me, the only thing that came through my head was, what would he think of me if I don't do this? And I just took a big old inhale, and he gave me another, and I took another big old inhale. And here's what I can share with you about that night. That every time that man went to the bathroom, I followed him in there. That's what happened. But I did find a cure for the blackouts. And so I was in Florida recently for a men's conference, and it was in Central Florida, not far from the University of Florida. What I told them is what really the truth is, that cocaine is really just Gatorade for the drinking man, and they love that there, you know. They just, yeah. The trouble with all that, then I got a front row seat to my life. I got a front row seat being present for my life and what was happening to me. And I took another hostage. And I got sent to treatment. I had two of my classmates show up in my law office one day, and they had an airplane ticket, and they said, listen, you're in trouble, and we know it, and you got two choices. You could take this ticket, and we've got a setup for you to go to a treatment center in Arizona, or if you don't, we're going to go down to the Bar Association, and we're going to have your ticket pulled. Well, I'm no dummy, you know. I said, what time does the plane leave, you know? I mean, but I didn't go because I thought I had a problem. And I didn't go because I thought it would be a good thing. And I didn't go because I thought, man, I really got in trouble with this alcohol deal. I went because I needed to do one thing and one thing only, and that was fade some heat. And I got on that airplane, and I went to a treatment center. I got served divorce papers just before I left on our one-year wedding anniversary. That's probably not a good sign. It's right there. I got served divorce papers. I went to treatment. I got one of these books out there in treatment. I know it was a third edition. I know I got it. I know I must have read it. There was highlights in there, underlines. You know, when I left, it looked like my high school yearbook. You're going to do great, you know, and all this stuff. I came back to Oklahoma City, and they told me I needed to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember as a kid growing up down in Hugo and on the cable, they always had those PSA channels, you know, where it would roll through. And I remember seeing those as a kid. They were kind of a flip deal, like a flip chart. And it would flip through, and it would say something like this, you know, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop drinking, that's our business, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they have a number there. And I remember that as a kid. It's funny how things like that stick with you. How things reflecting back on your life. I think about things like that, and they kind of stick with you. But anyway, I got out of that treatment center. They told me I need to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, where do they meet? And they told me about a place that was not too far from my office. It was a couple of miles from my office. And so they said they have meetings at noon there. And so that's where I went. There's a place called the Western Club in Oklahoma City. Now, a lot of you folks have been to metropolitan areas. Most metropolitan areas, you know, in Oklahoma City, there's probably 1,000 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every month. I don't know how many. There's a bunch. You know, about every time you find a gas station or a former treatment center, there's a, you know, there's an AA meeting somewhere close. And so, you know, they're everywhere, man. And on that clubhouse where I went to, there's a big board that has a list of all the meetings on there. But what I heard those people say was that Alcoholics Anonymous meets at noon, you know? And that's what I did. I went to noon meetings, and that's what I did. And they said, you know, you need to get a sponsor. And I found a guy, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And what I want you to know is that I had done everything necessary to qualify for my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous the very first day I arrived there. I had done all the research out there necessary for me to own and have a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous on the day that I walked in the door. But what I need to share with you is this, is that book I had that I brought back from that treatment center, I never darkened this door ever again. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he gives us precise, specific, clear-cut directions on the actions that I need to take one day at a time. By taking those certain actions in here, it guarantees that one day at a time that I can stay sober. But I didn't do any of that. What I did was I went to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I did is I became the same kind of guy I was back in school. I became a chameleon and a pretty good parrot. You know, I would sit in those meetings, and I would hear what you would say, and I would just repeat that stuff back. I didn't do anything to hold my seat. I was really like a helicopter. You guys have probably got helicopters up here, don't you? I float in about 5 minutes after the meeting starts, you know, and I'll wave to you, sorry, I've been busy. You know, float in. I'll hover over my seat. Then about 5 minutes before the meeting's over, poof, I'm gone again. You know, I just fly out the door. And I can't hold my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm not willing to take the actions necessary for me to hold it. And I stayed there for 5 years, and during that time period, I found another hostage. We produced a hostagette. And one hot August day, I was in Dallas, Texas, on a big deal, doing big-time stuff for big-time money. I'm a legend in my own mind, you know. And somebody asked me the wrong question. Somebody said, would you like a glass of wine with dinner? And I hadn't had a drink in 5 years. Would you like a glass of wine with dinner? And I said, yes. And I had that glass of wine, and I walked back out to my car that night, and in my mind, I was going, see, not alcoholic, not alcoholic. I can have a glass of wine. Besides that, I didn't put my tie on my head and try to dance with somebody else's wife. You know, it's probably a good deal. I'm not alcoholic. And I got back in my car, and I drove back to Oklahoma City. That was August of 1993. Now, at that period of time, I had my own law firm at that time. I had 30 people that worked directly for me. I tell you this just so you can, I need you to understand what I'm willing to trade, not give away, not lose. I never lost anything. If I tell you I've lost something, that implies that one day I might be moving some laundry and find it, you know. What I need to do is I need to set the stage for you so you can understand what I'm willing to give up and trade to live the kind of life that I want to live. I had this whole floor, this big-time office building in downtown Oklahoma City. 30 people worked direct for me. I had a house on the country club, 3 cars in the garage. I got the hostagette. I got a good life. If you look at me from outside, if you look at me the way everybody out there looks at us, if you look at us, if you looked at me by the trappings that those people out there hold us to, my life looked good. My life looked like I had it going on, like I had it together. But inside, you know what the deal is. The deal is on the inside is what I've had all my life. From that very first day in kindergarten, see, I haven't felt good. Not that I've been sick. Not that I've been physically ill. But when I came here finally, what you guys told me is, Cliff, you're just irritable, restless, and discontented. And I've been that way all my life. And what I've come to understand that really is some form of spiritual dehydration. You know, I suffer from a spiritual dehydration that causes me to be irritable, restless, and discontent. And so I have all these trappings that look really good on the outside, but on the inside I'm dying. You know, I'm just dying. And I have that glass of wine. I come back, and you know what I decide? I may start making really good decisions for myself. What I decide is I need to get a girlfriend and get my social life going again, you know. And so Christmas, 2 days before Christmas, and 1993. I come home and I go to my kitchen. It's about 7 o'clock at night, and I go in the kitchen. I grab 7 black garbage bags, and I go back to my room and I start putting everything that's important to me in my life in those bags: my clothes, my shirts, my shoes. My little girl is 3 years old, and it's 2 days before Christmas. And as I'm hauling bags out to the car, she's hanging on my leg saying, "Daddy, please don't go. Please don't go." I don't know what your alcohol, I don't know where your alcoholism takes you. I don't know what you're willing to trade to drink and live the way that you want to live. But for me, what I did was I stepped right over that little girl, packed the stuff that was important to me, and got on with my life. And what I need to tell you is that for the next 8 years, my life became a living hell. Alcohol took me immediately. And I mean, I began that vicious spiral down, down, down. And once I start drinking, I can't quit. You know, I didn't know. I didn't pay any attention to those meetings. I didn't know I suffered from this twofold illness. I don't know that I've got an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. You know, I don't know that. You know, if they've said it, I'm sure they did. I got a book that I've underlined it. I must have read it, but it didn't connect, because you know why? I'm out there for all the wrong reasons. I'm in treatment because somebody wants me there, not because I believe I need to be there. I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I want to be there, because I think they're watching me and I just need to get them off my back. And you know what? I hung on to that as long as I could. I lived off and sucked off your sobriety as long as I could, until I got so irritable, restless, and discontent. When somebody said, "Would you like a glass of wine?" the thought process was nil. I just said yes. Because what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me is that there'll come a time when I'll have no effective mental defense against the first drink. And in Dallas, Texas, on that night, I didn't have it, and my life began hell all over again. And I walked out of that house with those people, that little girl, and that hostage. The court set them free, and that was okay one more time. One more time, that was all right in my life. One more family mowed over and destroyed. But you know, I rationalize and justify. What I do is I suffer from delusional thinking. I'm delusional. I think that's okay. I think that's perfectly all right. And I go about living my life. And what happens is that my life explodes. And that law firm I have downtown, I quit showing up. When the rainmaker quits making rain, it dries up. And I had a legal assistant had a key to my apartment. He would come over and he'd have to wake me up and I'd have to sign papers. Judges would call my office and say, "Where is he? Where is he? I don't know where he is," and they'd have to have other lawyers cover for me. You know, people just covered and looked over and passed over, and then finally it blew up, and it all exploded. And the hostage and the hostageette were set free, and then somewhere along that line, I met Lori. And Lori had never been around people like us, you know? She has never had, are you sitting down? She has never had a drink in her whole life. Third eye. I know. That's crazy, man. You know. I know. So immediately she decided to move in with me to help me. And so what happened was yeah. And what I need to tell you is the last 3 years of my drinking, I didn't work. You know. I had a big child support payment. What you need to know is Lori paid that for me. She had a really good job, and she was making good money, and she made my child support payment. I had a big mortgage on a house, and you know what? Lori made that payment, too. I had a car payment. She made it. Electric bill, gas bill, phone bill. She made it. See, I'm one step away from being institutionalized because I can't take care of myself. In the last 3 years of my drinking, I couldn't get out of my house. Now, if you're here this weekend and you're looking for a guy this afternoon to give you a story about how he was put in jail, raped 7 times, and somehow lived through that, that ain't me. I've never been to jail. I've never had handcuffs on. Nothing like that ever happened to me. But I'm going to tell you, I was a prisoner in my house for 3 years, and I held the keys, and I couldn't get out. I couldn't get out of my own house. And my mother and my father, they would try to help me, and they just didn't know how. They just didn't know how to help me. And Lori started running me around a psychiatrist to try to get me help. And she ran me around to one who finally figured me out. And this lady had, at the time when she took me, she had 8 years in Al-Anon. And she took me to this lady, and on the second visit, she had figured me out because she'd asked, tell me what's going on. And I was telling Lori, she said, I don't understand why you don't sleep at night. And I said, well, I've got a sleeping disorder. And I didn't tell her it was self-induced. I just tell her a sleeping disorder. So this lady figured me out. And she gave Lori these two big, this bottle of pills. And she said, give him one at 5:30. And if he's still awake at 10, give him another one. Now, what I heard her say was, listen, we're going to have to triple up on everything we're doing to beat this deal. That's all we're going to do. I'm in, you know. So what happened on that particular night is I just had some kind of schizophrenic whiteout. That's the best I can tell you. And I barricaded myself in my room. The next morning, on the other side of the house, the next morning, Lori came and broke in on me. And this is the guy you got for your speaker today. You know, I broke in the room, and there I am. I'm naked to the world. You know, there's an empty bottle of vodka and a wine bottle on the floor. There's a little baggie that you would normally put fishing lures in, but it had some white residue on this particular day in there. The screen on the TV was blue where the adult movies had run out. The ceiling fan's on, and I'm trapped in this room, and I'm passed out. Now, she'd like to tell you that when she came in, she kind of woke me up and said, honey, what is this? But what I want to tell you was that she hit me like I'd been shot out of a cannon that morning. And she shook that bag of dope at me, and she goes, what the hell is this? Well, I want to tell you guys, at that particular time, I've been practicing law for about, 18 years. I probably tried 50-something jury trials, multi-million-dollar trials. And on that particular morning, the very best argument I had was, I don't know. That's all I had. That's all I got. Those people that barricaded the room must have dropped that on the way out. That's best I know. Then there was some discussion about whose house it was. You know, that happens sometimes. And come to find out, it was more her house on that particular day than mine. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know what else to do. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was June 30th of 2001. And I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm vibrating. There was an old man there. This old man, Don Cohn. And I say his name because his family's given me permission to do that. Every day after the meetings, he would come up to me. He'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I said, Donnie, I'm good. And he'd say, man, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. I said, you got it. You'll know. For 45 days, Don did that for me. And I would go to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous starting June 30th of 2001. And all of Charlie Brown's people were there. You guys ever been to those meetings? Just wonk, 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 you know? Jesus. Man. And it didn't really matter because I've got a full-blown stockholders meeting going on in my head, you know? I mean, some people talk about a committee. If I could get it to a committee, it would be a bonus, man. You know? It's a full-blown stock. It was like Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. Just everybody's yelling and it's crazy up there. I can't focus on anything. But I'd break and run after the Lord's Prayer, and Don would catch me. He'd sit right by the door. He'd catch me. And he'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I'd give him the same line every time. Well, I hung in there as long as I could. I'm just going to tell you, if you're a real live alcoholic and you stop drinking, it's my experience that your life will get worse. And let me tell you, the worst place you could possibly be is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you want to drink. I'm just telling you, man. Because I want out of there as quick as I can. But Donnie would catch me. And he'd grab me, and he did what the book talked about. He kept it friendly. He would just ask me how I was, and he'd offer me his help. He kept it friendly. You know, that's what it talks about in working with others. We just find out about people, talk to them. We offer them our way of life. If they're not interested, we leave it friendly, man. We just tell them, hey, if you ever want to call us, let us know. And that's how Donnie did it. He just catch me every day. Well, I stood it as long as I could, man. Somewhere in the middle of August, I just popped because I'm unwilling to surrender. You know, I had one more plan and one more idea. See, I think Alcoholics Anonymous works best for a guy like me when I'm totally out of plans and ideas. If I've got any kind of plan and idea about how I can manage and run my life, the chances of Alcoholics Anonymous working for me are probably not very good. Matter of fact, it tells us in here when we're working with other people, if they have any other thing they suggest, we just say, hey, well, you know, let us know if that works. And if it doesn't, give me a call, you know, whatever. And for me, I just had one more explosion, you know, and I came home, you know, I was out of town. I came home and Lori caught me at the door. My eyes, they looked like the guy off Jaws, you know, the shark eyes and that shark that's in this deal down here, you know, just black eyes. And she met me at the door. She said, "You've been drinking." I said, "No, I haven't." She said, "Well, we're going to do a drug test." That's when I started negotiating. And I figured if I could hold her off for like 72 hours, I could get away with it, you know. Yeah. More discussion about whose particular house it was that night, and you know, it just wasn't a good deal. And I went out and I passed out in my front driveway in my car. It was the best I could do. And you know, the next day I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was August the 15th of 2001, which is the very last time I'm hopeful that I ever have to raise my hand if they say, "Is there somebody new or nearly new here?" You know, one more time I had to raise my hand. And on that particular day, I'm sitting at that meeting, and all Charlie Brown's people are there one more time, just wonk, 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 wonk. And there's about 20 minutes left in the meeting. And it just got quiet, and the head just went quiet. And this thought floated through. And the thought was, "Cliff, if you don't do something different today, you're going to die." And for some reason, I hung on to that. And I got up out of that meeting, and they said the Lord's Prayer. And I broke and ran for the door, and Donnie caught me on the 45th day. And he said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I said, "Man, Donnie, I'm not doing good at all." He goes, "I know, I know." Yeah, psychic, you know. He said, "Well, listen, man, if there's ever anything I can do to help you, let me know." And I said, I made a statement. That's what I want you all to be really clear about today. I made a statement, not a question, a statement. I said, "You know, man, I need a sponsor." Statement. And what Donnie did was what the book of Alcoholics Anonymous said we should do. He just said, "Well, let's sit down here and talk about that." And he had me sit down with him. And because Donnie knew I couldn't ask for help. Donnie knew that that the illness of alcoholism had me in its grips. And he knew he was watching me die right in front of his eyes for the last 45 days. And he just kept trying to reach me. But he didn't give me frothy emotional appeal, you know. What Donnie brought was a message with depth and weight. He brought a message out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He brought a message of the program of action. And what Donnie did on that particular day, he set me down. He said, "You know, Cliff," he said, "around here we got suggestions." He said, "But a guy like you, you need requirements." Yeah. And I thought, all right, requirements. I'm thinking it's a good thing, you know. He said, he said, "I need you to call me every day." And I took out the cell phone that Lori was still paying for, and I showed it to him. And he said, "Well, put my number in there." And I put his number in there. He said, "Around here," he said, "you know, we have this deal. We go 90 meetings in 90 days. He said, "You just forget all that stuff." He said, "What I want to know from you is, can you be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day?" Now, I hadn't worked for 3 years. I had a pretty busy schedule. And I had to think about that. It's amazing. It is amazing what the alcoholic ego will do. In the throes of death, one step to the grave. I mean, I am in you know, 15 minutes before this, I had this thought that if I don't do something different, I'm going to die. This guy cares enough about me to sit down. He's talking to me, and he says, "Can you be in a meeting every day?" And I got to think about it, man. I'm going to tell you, if there were cancer patients today, and they told them, "Listen, what you got to do is you got to get a book, you got to read it, you got to do a few things, you got to be in a meeting every day," this place would be in hell where the Blazers play in Portland, Oregon. It wouldn't hold enough people. But guys like me, who suffer from this peculiar mental twist, as the book describes it, this parallel thinking, you know, that along with my sound reasoning is always gives way to some trivial excuse to drink. You know, I got to think about a guy who's offering me a solution and a way out. But I said, "Yes, I can do that." Yeah. And then the last thing he said to me, he said, "Cliff, now here's the deal breaker." He said, "Whenever I ask you to do something," he said, "you know what, I don't need you to go home and come back tomorrow and share about how you feel about it. You know, I don't need your input. I don't need any suggestions from you. Whenever I ask you to do something, you're going to agree to it, and you're going to do it. And if you can't do that, I can't help you." And for some God-forsaken reason, I said yes to that too. You know? We talked a little more. I got up, and I got in my car, and I went back to that office where I'd been thrown, banished to the boondocks. Back to the office where I didn't have anything to do. And on my way back there, I thought, what the hell did I just agree to, man? You know? And I start thinking about all that. And you know, get me alone for a little bit. I'm dangerous, you know? And I start thinking about that. And then I get back and Lori calls me. And she says, you know, I'd like to see you this evening after work. Of course, she meant her work because I wasn't doing anything, you know. You know, I was unemployed, you know. I was self-employed and unemployed. And so that's code. Self-employed is just code for unemployed with a pickup in here. That's what you need to know. So, and so I don't know if any of you ever had those situations arise in your life where somebody says, you know, I need to talk to you. And you're pretty sure you know what the subject matter will be. I don't know about you, I start working on my talk. I do, man. And the very fortunate thing for me is I had three other women make this same phone call, so I had a talk kind of prepared. You know, I hadn't used it in a while, but it was pretty good. I mean, I fairly used material, and I could work on it, but I took it out, brushed it off, started working on it. And so I went home, and I waited on her. And she came in, and I had my back to her when she came in because I'm really, you know, trying to beat her to the ignore because I'm pretty mature at this point. And I'm just 41. Anyway, so she comes in, and she asks me to turn around. And then she takes my hand. I thought, she's trying to give me the let me down easy deal. I can tweak the talk a little bit for that, you know. So, and she just looks at me. She said, listen, what you need to know is I just love you. And it's going to be all right. And I'm not going anywhere. But something's going on with you, and you got to get honest with me. And whatever I have to do, whatever I have to do, I'm willing to do it. But you got to do your part. And if you're willing to do your part, I'm going to hang in here and do my part, whatever that needs to look like. But if you can't, I can't stay. And for some reason, two people on the same day got the same story, the truth. And I hadn't told the truth to one person in a long, long time. And what happened was my journey began back with you all. My journey began back in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I did, I just started following the old man around. And he would come pick me up, and he would come take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the most important thing he did for me was he got me in this book. And from the very first, what Don would do for me, he would sit down, we would read this book together. And then every time it came to somewhere and there was an action to take, we would take the action that the book told us and indicated for us to do. If it said we asked, we prayed. If it said, you know, we write, we wrote. Whatever it asked us to do, that's what I did. Highlight, underline. If he had notes in his book, he'd say, make this note right here, write that right there. And then he explained to me what that meant and what it did. And he began to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, a lot of people come here and they use, vernacular is important for a guy like me. I'm a wordsmith. A lot of people come in here, and I don't criticize it. I'm not criticizing. Please don't take this comment as criticism. A lot of people come here and they talk about working the steps. The word working the steps is nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. What it says is here are the steps we took. We take these steps and we apply them to our life, and through applying these things to our lives change by the actions indicated in this book, by the actions we take. By application, we begin to change. And that's what happened to me. I began to take the actions indicated in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life began to change. You know, when I was a little kid growing up in Hugo, I was a bull rider. So you know I'm certifiable crazy. So I'm fearless. I'm afraid of everything. So I figured out the one thing that was the worst possible thing you can do. I go, I'll do that. That's what I'll do. Because if I do that, I won't be afraid. If I do this, I won't be afraid. I became a bull rider. And I was pretty good at that. And then one time I was at a rodeo, and I rode this bull, and I got off of him, and he turned on me, and he hit me from behind, and he rolled me over, and it dinged me up, and I wasn't quite sure what had happened to me. I came up on my knees, and my whole back just seemed to kind of vibrate, and the guys caught me, and I went home, and my neck swelled up, and I laid around for about a week, and man, the pain just got so bad that finally I told my mom, I said, man, I got to go to the hospital. It's just bad. And they go in, they start x-raying, and they said, man, you've got a fracture between your second and third vertebrae. And they said, you're really lucky because a deal like this is really only two things happen to you. Very rarely are people ever paralyzed from something like that. You either die or you live, and you're lucky because you're still alive. And so I didn't feel real lucky. And what they did, they put me in a hospital bed for 6 weeks all summer long. And I laid there all summer long thinking about how this God that I heard in that little Southern Baptist church on Saturday morning had screwed me. That's what I really thought about. How this power, I'd found one thing in my life that I liked to do and that I was somewhat good at, and it had taken it away from me. And I laid all summer long with what I now know today to be what we call here a resentment against God. You know, I just thought I was mad at him, but apparently it was a resentment. And I got out of that hospital, and they told me, you know, you can't, like, I couldn't rodeo ever again. I couldn't bull ride ever again, and I just didn't know what to do. And there was my old vocational agriculture teacher, because I grew up on a farm ranch, whatever impresses you the most. That's what I grew up on. And my dad also owned a liquor store, and that caused me a lot of shame. He was originally a bootlegger. It was secrets. I couldn't tell people what my daddy did. And we did have about 160-acre cattle ranch and whatever. And so that's what I used to tell people my family did, you know, they were in the cattle business. And there's a kind of a throwaway to make you think we were some kind of conglomerate. I'd say we also have a liquor store, you know. And my ag professor got me into public speaking, and we had some success at that, because he would tell me, he said, you know, you're always telling those stories out here. Why don't you tell some of those somewhere else? And so I did. And so I was, my friend of mine, a young lady in my class, her father was the minister of the First Baptist Church there in Hugo. And she invited me to go. They were having a revival there. I don't know if there's anybody here who comes from any kind of evangelical type religions. And I want you to understand, whatever I tell you about this day, it's not a knock on religion. It's just my experience. It's only my experience, and it's only how I interpret it. You can interpret it however you want. But she asked me to go, so I did. And these places, they were revivals. They just bring in these charismatic ministers that give these talks. And their job is to just collect as many souls for God as they can. That's their job. And, man, I was moved. I went down, did an altar call, and it was a great thing. And I turned to my friend. I said, you know, maybe this is the deal. Maybe all this has happened to me because I've been called to preach. And she said, well, you need to talk to my daddy. I said, okay. So she takes me to her daddy, and I tell him this. And he goes, well, you need to talk to this evangelist. And I said, okay, I'll talk to him. And so I have a conversation with him. And he says, I'd like to meet you for dinner on Thursday night at 6 o'clock. And we're going to talk about this some more. And I said, okay. And so I go have dinner with this guy. And I should have known, you know, Madeline gave us a great example of a story where a guy rode into town that everybody was waiting on. He came in on a jackass. And this guy pulled up in a Mercedes. That should have been my first tip. And but I was just impressed by that. So, and he's starting to get to know me. He asked questions. And so he's asking me, tell me about your family. And I'm sharing, you know. And he asked me, well, tell them what they do. And I tell them the standard line I tell everybody. I said, you know, they're in the cattle business. And I could see this guy right now as if he's sitting right in front of me. And he's going up with some mashed potatoes. And he's got one piece of corn hanging off of him, man. And I say, and we own a liquor store. And I swear he double clutched on me, you know. And he looked at me. And this is the statement he made. Because as I reflect back on it today, I understand the question. But when I was 16 years old and I'm just running. You know, I suffer from untreated alcoholism and I'm running. I'm just trying to find a place to fit. I'm looking to get my 15 minutes caught up somewhere. Just find me some place I can fit in. He looks at me and says, son, your family's in the liquor business and you think you've been called to preach. Now, that's what he said. It's a legitimate question. But as a 16-year-old kid sitting there scared to death, my mind said, what my mind heard was that no matter what you do in this lifetime, you'll never have God's grace. You'll never have it. And so this separation got bigger. This idea that somehow God, the world, the universe, and everything's here and Cliff's out here got bigger. A bigger separation. And so I drag that into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I bring here. That's what I drug in. And I'm trying to tell Donnie about this. I'm sharing with him because he's asking me about a concept of a power when we get to that, you know, and I'm talking to him about it. He says, well, I don't really care about that. Because he's sensitive that way. And, you know, my thought was, why the hell you ask? You know, so. But I didn't say that. And so, so what happened was 30 days, like all good disenfranchised Baptists, what I did somewhere along my way, I became Catholic. And so, because being Catholic kind of fit the motif I had going at the time. You know, they're really busy up front. They got a lot of activities going on up here. Some of the things I were doing, I had a lot of activities going on, a lot of different stuff, you know, so I can kind of relate to it. And so anyway, I became Catholic. And what I know today is I'm still running. I'm just looking and I'm running. You know, when I was at Oklahoma State University, I had, when I was a freshman there, homecoming's a big deal there. Once Friday morning, we were moving this big scaffolding, and there were seven guys holding this scaffolding, and four of them had tennis shoes on, and three of them had cowboy boots, and it tipped and hit an electric line. And I'm probably from here to Lori when they tipped that line and they hit it. And the guys that wore tennis shoes, the electricity hit that, and they blew them away from it. And the three guys that had cowboy boots on, it stuck them. And I watched three guys, one of my roommates, sit right there and die right in front of me. And the best solution I had that day, I called my mom and dad and I ran home. And I stayed drunk for a week. I didn't make any of the funerals. I stayed drunk for a week. And I kept thinking, you know, I'm running from. I'm scared to death. And, you know, my friend's dying. I can't stay for him. I can't stay sober for him. I'm dragging all this into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm watching this. He keeps asking me about this power. And, man, I'm saying the power is nothing but a screw job. That's what the power is. But he don't really want to hear that. And 30 days sober, Lori comes to me and says, listen, the church we go to is having the history of the Catholic Church, and I'd like for you to go with me. And I said, you know, honey, that's the night my home group meets. I can't go. And so the next day I'm talking to Don, and, you know, at 30 days sober, I don't know about you guys, I have a lot of problems. And so I'm sharing, not in a general way, you know, And he's asking me, and I'm telling him, and I said, and Lori, and I'm telling him, she wants me to go to this deal with her, and he lets me get all the way through it. He lets me get through the whole, you know, 10 minutes worth of issues of the day. And I get done, he said, go back to what Lori wants. Oh, God, Don's getting senile. So I go back, and I review. And he said, well, Bub, see, there's where you got it wrong. He said, see, that woman saved your life. And if that's what she wants you to do, then you're going to do that. And so I went back to Lori that afternoon. I said, listen, I've been thinking about that. I think I can go with you. And it takes some of us a little while to get rigorously honest here. That's all I can share with you about that. But see, that's why sponsorship is so important here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because left of my best thinking, see, I'm going to miss the trick. I'm going to miss the thing that's going to save my life. And what happened was that this old priest was teaching this class, a guy named Father Mollen. He's gone to his reward, and I got to go to his wake. And it's the second class, and it's a two-hour deal. Man, it's boring. I'm just sharing with you guys, and it's boring. And I'm 30 days sober. I'm still shaking and vibrating, you know. And if you set me down and you feed me a little bit, I'm out. I'm just going out, man. And but Father Mollen used to tell these corny jokes. And he started telling a story, which I thought was a joke, and so I listened. And he said, you know, where I grew up in Chicago, from the time I was a little boy, from the time I was like 5 or 6 years old, when I'd go to play with my friends, I'd have to cross a cemetery. And he said, that's no big deal, except at night. He said, at night, I would get on the other side of that cemetery. He said, and what would happen? He said, I'd get to the gate, and in my mind's eye, what I would see is all these dead people coming out of the ground to get me, you know. The trees would be monsters, and they were going to grab me, you know. He said, so what I would do, he said, I would hit that gate. He said, and what I would do is I would just run as fast as I could through that cemetery. He said, but if I ever got caught at night, on the other side of that cemetery, and my daddy was with me, he said, you know what I'd do? He said, I'd just put my hand in my daddy's hand, I'd puff my chest out, and I'd walk through that cemetery knowing for a fact that everything was going to be okay. And he said, that's how God is. And for the very first time in my life, I heard that. And then he said, you know, God is your number one fan. And I heard that too. And my life changed. The curtains fell. You know, Bill talks and describes it as the prides and prejudices scales fell from his eyes. When he talks about when he and Ebby were sitting at that table talking. And you know what? Ebby never promised Bill, listen, Bill, if you'll do these things, you'll never drink again. What Ebby says to Bill in his story, he said, Bill, if you'll do these things, you'll enter into a new relationship with your Creator. And that's what happened for me. And I went to Don the next day, and it was Monday night. It was Monday night football. And Don would have me over, but he would at least mute the TV when I was there, you know. And I'm telling him all this stuff that's happening, and he's going, yeah, yeah, you know. And at least he would look at me every once in a while. And I'm telling the story. I don't think he's listening, but I'm telling him anyway. And I get to the end of it, and he just kicks the ottoman out. And he crawls down on the floor on his knees. And he said, open the book to the third step prayer. Now, Don had been saying the third step prayer for probably 13 years. He's 13 years sober then. But what Don did for me was something that was very profound. Don opened the book to the third step prayer. And what he did, he said it with me. No better than, no separate from. Everyone that comes here is welcome. And everyone who comes here is on equal footing. And he held my hands and we read the third step together, the third step prayer together. I got up, I went about my way. And he said to me, he said, now when you get home tonight, what you're going to do is that you're going to get some pencil and paper and you're going to get ready and you're going to get busy writing it. And so what I want to share with you is that I got really busy doing a four step. And it took me exactly 8 hours. I mean, eight. It took me 8 months, 3 hours, and 27 minutes to get it done. Huh? The most important part is the 3 hours and the 27 minutes. That's the important part. See, you know? The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says next. And I had to go look that word up after a few months. Don had me looked up what next meant, you know. Next means like the next indicated action is what it means, you know. And I did a fifth step with an old guy, and, you know, what happened is my life chain began to change in Alcoholics Anonymous. It began to change because I became willing to take the actions that were indicated in the book. It doesn't have really anything to do. Matter of fact, it doesn't matter how I think, what I feel, what I believe, what my emotions are. What matters in here only is my experience is what I do. It's what I do. Because I would have bet you $100 that I didn't have, that I had to borrow from Lori. I'd have bet you $100. That if I do these things, it wasn't going to work. And sometimes I'm convinced if I can get people to bet with me, if you'll just bet with me that this will, if you'll do these things, I'm willing to pay you $100 if it doesn't work. You know, I think it's better when we come here and we don't believe anything almost. If we can come in here and just wipe the slate and start. If I'm not burdened with the prejudices I drag in here. You know, in the chapter, We Agnostics, it mentions the word prejudice 7 times. And Jesus, I was full of prejudice when I got here. I drug all that stuff into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just dumped it on all you people. I didn't know what else to do with it, but you guys just love me. Don gave me my very first job in AA. He gave me the coffee job. That's the best job in AA, I swear to God. It is the absolute best job in AA. And you know what? What he would do is the meeting started at 12, and what he would have me do there would be there at 11:30 to make the coffee. Now listen, I don't know about you, but there's nothing worse than being somewhere you don't want to be. The next worst thing is being somewhere 30 minutes early to somewhere you don't want to be, right? But Don had me get there early and have me making the coffee, and that became my job at that meeting, making the coffee. Then somebody else's sponsor gave somebody else that job. And I noticed they started getting there earlier. So now I had to get there earlier to make the coffee, you know what I mean? But that's how it is here. What I found is the best thing I can do for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is have a job here. Is have a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, this happens to be my particular job today. But, you know, it's not the most important thing I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about the least important thing I do in AA, to be honest with you. See, the most important thing I do in Alcoholics Anonymous and the thing I've been doing for the last 13-plus years is on the fourth Thursday of every month, I take a meeting to a treatment center. I was 3 months sober when my sponsor gave me that job. And I told him, I said, I don't have anything to share with those people. He said, you're right. But just go down there and do it anyway, you know? And you know, the Thursday that I do, it always falls on Thanksgiving. It always falls on Thanksgiving. And so when people ask me, what are you going to do on Thanksgiving? I say, I'm going to take a message of hope to the ungrateful is what I'm doing, man, today. Just taking a message of hope to the ungrateful. Because what happens is here that we have this commonality, this community that we build in Alcoholics Anonymous here. You know, this piece of puzzle that we have, this part, this common problem coupled with a common solution that we have here. And it's important to me that the message that people hear from me and the guys that I sponsor in our group is a message that's as clear and precise and as clear-cut as the directions are in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the very worst thing as I want is that I want for one of your kids to show up here and they get a watered-down version of Alcoholics Anonymous and they say, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for me, and they're out the door, you know. I sponsored a lot of guys' kids in Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a daughter that was out. And Lori was here, when she was here last year, she told you guys that Rachel had just gotten sober on January 13th of 2014. And what I'm happy to report to you today is that on January the 13th of 2015, she celebrated her one-year sobriety birthday. And the next day, she gave us a granddaughter. So that was a birth. I'm not saying it's going to happen for you. I'm just saying, you know. Just another gift of sobriety. That's what I'm talking about here. So, you know, but we have this. What's important for me is that the message here is clear and that it's important that we understand this sense of community that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I came here, there was an old man that cared enough about me to stand by the door and catch me. He's cared enough about me to stay with me. The thing I can tell you about Don is Donnie never gave up on anybody. Don had gone to a Green Bay Packer game about a year and a half ago, and he was so excited. He went up there with his son. They went up and watched a Packer game. He had a cheese head. They took pictures of him. He came back. I was so sick of hearing the Green Bay Packer stories for like 2 days, you know. And then Don's sponsor called me on Wednesday afternoon. He said, Coney's gone. I go, where did he go? And he said, no. Coney's dead. They found him at his house this morning about noon, and he's gone. And, you know, the hard part about that is Alcoholics Anonymous here prepares us for a lot of things. I lost my father in Alcoholics Anonymous. I lost my mother in Alcoholics Anonymous. I basically became an orphan here. And I lost my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I need to tell you about that is before they got Don carted out of that house that day, that I had somebody else to be my sponsor. Because here's what I can tell you about that. That Don Cone did not want me walking around the face of this earth unsupervised by somebody. You know? He cared enough about me to catch me every day at that door. And I was not going to disrespect his memory to walk on this earth without somebody else holding hands with me. It was the most important legacy that I could uphold for him, is to continue to be willing to be sponsored. Continue to be willing to be sponsored. There was an old farmer, and he was nailing up a sign, puppies for sale. And he was nailing it up, and he felt a tug on his leg, and he looked down at his overalls, and there was a little boy down there, and he was tuggies on his nail. He says, Mister, I'd sure like to buy one of your puppies. And he looked down at the little boy, he said, son, these are really expensive dogs. They come from really good parents, and they're going to be expensive. And the little boy looked in his pocket, and he fished around. 39 cents. Will that let me look at them? And the old farmer took the 39 cents, and he whistled. And here, Dixie. Dixie ran out of the doghouse down the ramp, and four little fur balls came after Dixie down the ramp. And the little boy leaned against the wooden fence, and his eyes just danced. And over in the doghouse, he saw something stir, and he looked back, and over there another fur ball appeared, smaller than the others. And he didn't run down the ramp, he slid down. And he kind of limped with a gimp, with a runt, and struggled to catch up with the other pups. And the little boy looked at him, he said, that's him. That's the one I want. And the old farmer knelt down by the boy and said, son, you don't want that one. That one's been hurt. And see, he'll never be able to run with you like the other dogs do, play with you. And the little boy backed up and he reached down and began to pull up his pant legs. And on each side of his pant legs were two steel braces, affixed to special shoes. And he said, well, you see, sir, I don't run too good either. And he'll need somebody who'll understand. With tears in his eyes, the old farmer stood back up. He reached down, and he handed the runt to the boy. And he said, how much? And the old farmer said, no charge. Your love is more than enough. Our hurtfulness here, our woundedness when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that piece of us which is so fractured, we find community here. Community in our common problem and community in our solution. What happened to me was that I figured out finally, at somewhere along the way, I quit running from something and I started running to something. And I know that one day that I'm going to meet the big guy and he's going to look at me and he's going to ask me only one question. He's going to say, Cliff, on August the 15th of 2001, I gave you a gift. What did you do with it? Thanks for having me.